This is IRIB English Radio.
Your headlines for this hour: Iran summons Sweden's envoy in protest over the desecration of the Quran in Stockholm, saying sacrilegious acts only incite terrorism and extremism. The Pentagon rejects reports about supplying Ukraine with long-range missiles. Moscow says giving such missiles to Kiev is a red line. And London Court of Appeal rules that the British government's plan to send asylum seekers to Rwanda is unlawful. Thank you for joining us. In today's top story, Iran's foreign ministry has summoned Sweden's charge d'affaires in Tehran over the recent desecration of the Holy Quran outside the mosque in Stockholm. During the meeting, the ministry's director general for Western Europe condemned the desecration of Islamic sanctities. The official slammed Sweden's inaction in the face of such sacrilegious acts, saying insulting Muslim sanctities is abuse of freedom of expression, which spreads hatred and violence. He also urged the Swedish government to take more effective and responsible steps to prevent insults to spiritual and religious values of Muslims. Iran's foreign minister also slammed the sacrilegious act, saying all Muslims condemn insult to holy scriptures and the Quran. Hossein Amir Abdollahian said allowing insult to the Holy Quran under any justification is misuse of democracy and freedom, which only incites terrorism and extremism. Iraqi protesters briefly breached the Swedish embassy in Baghdad over the burning of the Holy Quran in Stockholm. According to eyewitnesses, protesters remained inside for about 15 minutes before leaving peacefully after security forces were deployed. Protesters were rallying outside the embassy in response to a call by Shia Muslim leader Muqtada Sadr, who demanded the removal of the Swedish ambassador. The sacrilegious act in Sweden has drawn condemnations from Muslim countries. Turkey's president has said his country will react to the incident in the strongest possible terms.
As Turkey, I want it to be known that we will never yield to the politics of provocation or the politics of threat. We will show our reaction in the strongest possible terms until a determined victory against terrorist organizations and Islamophobia is achieved. We will eventually teach the arrogant Westerners that insulting the sacred symbols of Muslims is not freedom of thought.
The United Arab Emirates summoned the Swedish ambassador on Thursday to protest the desecration. In Beirut, the Lebanese Foreign Ministry and Hezbollah movement condemned the sacrilegious act. Meanwhile, the Yemeni government said targeting Islamic sanctities are encouraged by the Israeli lobby that dominates Europe. Elsewhere in Morocco, the government censured the desecration and recalled its ambassador to Sweden for an indefinite period. Jordan and Saudi Arabia also expressed vehement condemnations. On Wednesday, a man tore out pages of the Quran outside Stockholm Central Mosque and set some of them on fire. Director of Center for Muslim Affairs Jahangir Mohammed says the desecration of the Holy Quran reveals the West's double standard approach towards Islam and Muslims.
These type of incidents happen throughout Europe. When it comes to Muslims, it's classed as freedom of speech. When it comes to other communities, it's classed as hate, causing disorder, causing incohesion between communities, some form of racism. So for some communities, it's not acceptable, but against Islam and Muslims, it is. Earlier this year in Sweden, somebody tried to, just to show the double standards, set fire to a copy of the Torah They gained no permit because it was considered an act of hate. So there's double standards. Previously, the politician, Danish politician, has done the same in Sweden, where he's burnt copies of the Quran, Rasmus Paludin. So these are, and nobody believes, you know, this whole thing about freedom of speech in the West, when governments want to ban TVs, take them off the air.
Iranians taking part in Eid al-Adha prayers have condemned the desecration of the Holy Quran by a man in Sweden's capital during a protest authorized by the police. Kisumish Ahmadi has more.
On the occasion of Eid al-Adha, Iranians gathered in holy shrines and grand mosques across the country to perform special prayers. However, this year, the ceremony was marked by strong condemnations of the desecration of the Holy Quran in Sweden, which they unanimously called unacceptable.
They shouldn't have allowed anyone to desecrate our holy book. This is not right.
There is a lesson here. No act of sacrilege can be allowed in the name of freedom of speech.
One of the major Islamic holidays celebrated by Muslims worldwide every year, Eid al-Adha, is a festive occasion. The main ritual on this Eid is sacrificing livestock whose meat is donated to the poor and shared with relatives and friends.
On this day, Prophet Abraham's willingness to sacrifice his son as an act of obedience to God was rewarded. The lesson in this story that we should learn is to sacrifice our ego.
Al-Adha is a happy occasion. It's a holiday and a great time to celebrate weddings and other happy events.
More than anything, the occasion is a time to promote unity among Muslims worldwide, and celebrations usually last for 3 days. In Iran, until Eid al-Qadir, a week later.
Eid al-Adha is one of the major Eids in Islam. It is also referred to as the Feast of Sacrifice, and it is considered a time for sharing and giving. Gisumish Ahmadi, Tehran.
The U.S. Special Envoy for Iran has been placed on leave, the State Department says, amid reports that its handling of classified documents is under review. Robert Malley has confirmed that his security clearance is under review, saying he hopes the investigation would be resolved soon and favorably. Malley's deputy, Abraham Paley, will do his work while he's on leave without pay. According to media reports, Mali's security clearance was suspended earlier this year amid an investigation into his handling of classified material. Mali was a member of the U.S. team negotiating the 2015 deal with Iran under former President Barack Obama. Mali was also involved in talks held to restore the deal known as the JCPOA after Obama's successor Donald Trump quit the accord. The talks have been stalled for months, with Tehran citing Washington's refusal to provide guarantees it won't quit the pact again, amongst other issues. The U.S. Defense Department has dismissed American media reports about its decision to provide Ukraine with ATACM long-range missiles. The Pentagon spokesman ruled out any imminent decisions for supplying Kiev with long-range missiles. His remarks came after the Wall Street Journal reported that the U.S. was close to supplying Ukraine with such missiles. Kiev has repeatedly called on its Western allies to provide it with ATACM missiles, which have a range of some 300 kilometers. Ukraine says the missiles would help its forces strike Russian positions far behind the front lines. Washington has already provided Kiev with HIMARS launchers, which are capable of firing ATACM missiles. Back in October, Moscow said supplying Kiev with long-range missiles was a red line and Russia would respond to suppliers with specific measures. A UK court has blocked government plans to deport some asylum seekers to Rwanda. The country's Court of Appeals said the plan was unlawful. Rights groups and asylum seekers had appealed an earlier decision by another court which gave the go-ahead for the controversial deportation policy. Here's more.
After a long legal battle against the UK government's so-called Rwanda deportation plan, a welcome victory for rights campaigners and asylum seekers.
The result is that the High Court's decision that Rwanda was a safe third country is reversed, and that unless and until the deficiencies in its asylum processes are corrected, removal of asylum seekers to Rwanda will be unlawful.
It was a majority vote in the Royal Court of Appeal against a High Court decision in December last year that would have allowed the government to send asylum seekers arriving in the UK on small boats across the English Channel from France on a one-way trip to Rwanda, a plan slated by campaigners as immoral.
It's inhumane. They're treating people like they're not human beings. The reason why people are arriving on small boats in the UK is because they don't have safe passage. It's a deeply racist policy, because it particularly impacts on communities that are already racialized, already face the most race discrimination in the world. And this challenge by the government needs to stop.
That is yet to happen. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, who is grappling with high inflation, rising interest rates, and declining public support, has made this scheme one of his priorities. Reacting to the ruling, he said he disagreed with the court's decision and would do whatever necessary to make the deportations happen. According to official figures, more than 45,000 people entered the UK by crossing the Channel in 2022, a jump of more than 17,000 from the previous year's record. Many have since been held in detention.
It's awful. The conditions of detention centres in this country, in the UK, are worse than prison. So people are being held in horrific circumstances, in a situation that they have no control on, their lives essentially in limbo for long periods of time, and not knowing what's going to happen to them, whether they're just going to be put on a plane and deported at any moment. It's really demoralising.
The Boris Johnson-era plan, fervently pursued by incumbent Interior Minister Suella Braverman, aims to deport asylum seekers to the East African country of Rwanda as part of a $148 million deal to deter asylum seekers.
The UK government still has the option of appealing this court's decision to the Supreme Court in what's already been a long legal process, delays that will continue to have an impact on some of the most vulnerable people who risk their lives to reach Britain. Saeed Purizab, London.
Survey results by UK food bank charities show one in seven people in Britain faced hunger last year due to money shortage. The Trussell Trust says its research equated to an estimated 11.3 million people. It said the findings are just the tip of the iceberg. Earlier, another study indicated that hunger has become the new norm for millions of Brits amid an unprecedented rise in food prices. Ismo.
A landmark research study has revealed an excruciating extent of food poverty across Britain. The report by the Trussell Trust, which is an NGO and charity that works to end the need for food banks in the United Kingdom. The report says 14% of all UK adults or their households experienced food insecurity in the 12 months to mid-2022. That is an estimated 11.3 million people in the UK. This means that at some point over this period, they ran out of food and were unable to afford food, ate less, went hungry, or lost weight due to lack of money. It further notes that despite the growth in the number of food parcels provided by food banks and independent providers, more than two-thirds of those experiencing food insecurity did not receive food aid. According to the charity, the latest findings are just the tip of the iceberg, and the shortage of money is not limited to just hunger pangs among the impoverished Britons.
So I think if you look at last year, if you look at it overall, we saw the highest need ever for food banks. So we gave out 3 million food parcels. That was a 37% increase on the year before, more than a million for children for the first time. So if you look at it overall, even with every bit of support that was put in, we were still seeing a lot of people in really dire hardship.
The Trussell Trust report also says that working-age adults are much more likely to need to turn to a food bank than pensioners. This is particularly the case with single adults living alone and those not currently in paid work. Furthermore, families with children are at high risk of food insecurity. Nearly half, or 47% of all households experiencing food insecurity include children under the age of 16. It's said the impact of poverty leads to worrying social isolation and loneliness, spiraling debt, and a decline in physical and mental health. It has been argued that food banks, like the Trussell Trust, are fulfilling the duties that the government is supposed to take care of.
Food banks are a community-led response to need, so they're stepping into the gap in the absence of effective government policy. It isn't sustainable in the long term. Food banks are really meant to be a short-term intervention so families, so high schools can get back up on their feet again. But unfortunately, we're in a position now where, I guess, as a result of lack of policies that prioritise people that are on the edges of society, food banks are having to step in and provide the role of government.
Furthermore, the Institute of Development Studies at the University of Sussex says nearly a quarter of the population in Britain experienced hunger as the new normal. According to the study, a decade ago, the number of food banks in the UK was fewer than 100. However, in 2021, the number increased to over 2,000, with 9.7 million people in food poverty last September.
We've also found that even when people have been receipt of the general cost of living payment, the disability cost of living payment, and their full benefit entitlement, they have still had to make profoundly difficult choices about whether they can afford their essentials. So in our recent survey, we found that 26% of people with a learning disability who responded reported not turning the lights on, 35% reported skipping meals, and 38% had not used their heating when they were cold. So I think that just indicates that hardship for people with a learning disability has persisted even with the cost of living payments.
Well, those were the top stories for this hour. Thank you for listening. Take care and bye-bye.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In its early May offensive on the occupied Gaza Strip, the Zionist regime unlawfully destroyed Palestinian homes, often without military necessity, in what amounts to a form of collective punishment against the civilian population. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, Ahmad and Hassan Abdullah are two brothers with autism. On May 13th, during the latest Israeli regime war on the besieged Gaza Strip, their already challenging life was turned into a nightmare. At 5 in the morning, shrapnel from the Israeli Iron Dome system hit their house, located in the crowded Jabalia refugee camp in the northern Gaza Strip. Consequently, a major fire broke out. Khaled Mahmoud Abdullah, 51, is the father of Ahmad and Hassan. He told local media about the terrible day. We saw a cloud of black smoke rising and a state of fear and panic spread among the members of my family. I have two sons with autism and two daughters. Khaled continued, Our neighbors started screaming. The sight was terrifying. The flames were very high and red. What hurts me the most, he said after a moment of silence as the man tried to control his emotions, is that the fire destroyed all the handmade toys my wife had made for our two sons, Ahmad and Hassan. The two brothers' only safe shelter, their swing, and their little dolls had been reduced to a pile of ashes. Zainab Abdullah, the mother of the two boys, said, Ahmad and Hassan used to play with the toys I made for them. The Israeli occupation does not differentiate between children, women, and sick people. Autism is a neurological disorder characterized by difficulties with social interaction and communication and by restricted or repetitive patterns of thought and behavior, according to Maha Azam, a psychologist at the Palestinian Association for Autism and Rehabilitation. Azam added that life is especially difficult for autistic patients in the besieged Gaza Strip due to the Zionist regime's blockade and the continuous wars, pointing out that these patients would need more family and community rehabilitation programs. Also, according to Wafa News Agency, in its early May offensive on the occupied Gaza Strip, the fabricated regime of Israel unlawfully destroyed Palestinian homes, often without military necessity. Amnesty International investigated 9 Israeli regime airstrikes that resulted in the killing of civilians and in the damage and destruction of residential buildings in the Gaza Strip. 3 separate attacks on the first night of bombing on May 9th, in which precision-guided bombs targeted 3 senior Al-Quds Brigade's commanders, killed 10 Palestinian civilians and injured at least 20 others. They were launched into densely populated urban areas at 2 a.m. when 2 families were sleeping at home, which suggests that those who planned and authorized the attacks anticipated and luckily disregarded the disproportionate harm to civilians. Intentionally launching disproportionate attacks, a pattern Amnesty International has documented in previous Israeli operations, is a war crime. According to Wafa News Agency, on May 9th, Israeli regime forces began a 5-day offensive on the Gaza Strip, apparently targeting members and facilities of the Al-Quds Brigades. The Israeli regime attacks killed 11 Palestinian civilians, including 4 children. The Ministry of Health in Gaza reported that 190 people were injured, of whom 64 were children. The Israeli regime military operations damaged 2,943 housing units, including 103 homes which were completely destroyed. At least 1,244 Palestinians have been displaced due to the recent offensive, according to numbers provided by the Palestinian Ministry of Public Works. At 2 a.m. on May 9th, Israeli regime airstrikes hit a 2-story building in the Ash-Shafa district in Gaza City with GBU-39 bomb, a small diameter bomb manufactured by Boeing Defense, Space and Security, and exported to occupied territories of Palestine from the United States. The strike targeted the apartment of Khalil al-Bahtini, a senior member of al-Quds Brigade. It killed Khalil al-Bahtini, his wife Leila al-Bahtini, and their four-year-old daughter Hajar. The neighboring apartment was also struck, killing 19-year-old Dania Adas and her 17-year-old sister Iman. Ala Adas, Dania, and Iman's father told Amnesty International that he was woken up by his bedroom door falling on him. He ran to Iman and Dania's room and found his daughters in bed. Dania, whose wedding was due in July, was already dead. Iman, a keen student with dreams of becoming a doctor, was still breathing and was rushed to the hospital, where she died a few hours later. The Zionist regime's deliberate destruction of civilian homes also took a heavy toll on civilians in the Gaza Strip, including on people living with disabilities. On May 13th, Israeli regime forces targeted a four-story building in Jabalia refugee camp. The building was home to 42 people from the extended Naphan family. Five members of the family live with disabilities, including three being wheelchair users. Hossam Naphan, an eyewitness to the attack, told Amnesty International he had received a call he believed to be from Israeli intelligence officer at around 6 p.m., saying residents of the building had 15 minutes to evacuate. Hossam told the caller that there were people with disabilities in the building and they needed more time, but the caller just repeated the warning. After the strike, 22-year-old Hanin Naphan was so traumatized she found it hard to talk, saying that her wheelchair had been buried under the rubble of her home, so she could no longer move around independently. Research by Amnesty International found no evidence that Naphan building and other residential buildings destroyed or damaged during the last 2 days of the offensive had been used to store weapons or any other military equipment, or that rockets had been launched from their direct vicinity. The unlawful attacks on Palestinian homes and the illegal blockade imposed on Gaza since 2007 are part and parcel of the Zionist regime's apartheid system against Palestinians, which amounts to the crime against humanity of apartheid under both the Apartheid Convention and the Rome Statute.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
In your name rests an infinity of mercy and love, so in thy name I shall start. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear ladies. This is your program, Muslim Lady. I am Asma, and you're listening to IRB English Radio. Today in this studio, we have Sister Zainab with us to talk more about things that are just related to us as Muslim ladies. Assalamu alaikum, sister.
Walaikum assalam.
Thank you for being here. And thank you, dear ladies, for joining us in today's episode. Well, previously on Muslim Lady, we talked about backbiting, which is actually a flaw in our personality, and we have to work on it. We have to go for remedies. So we talked about the causes that might lead us into backbiting, which were just like spying and being the inspector who wants to know everything about every single person's life. And as human beings, we all know how not to go for them, but it needs too many practice. And then just as Sister Zainab was telling us more about backbiting, there was this simile this imagery that you mentioned from the Holy Book of Quran, there was a verse that said, is there any one of you who would like to eat the flesh of his dead brother's body? This is a horrible imagery. I mean, even the image, just imagining that picture would, you know, make you feel so sad and so, like, depressed. So what is the reason? What are the themes and the motifs behind this imagery?
As we have been talking about backbiting, in particular to women, because as you previously said, we don't want to, Muslim ladies to be indulged in this evil act. A Quran in itself gives the reason and also the remedy to this evil act, to this kind of disease, in the same verse that you have mentioned. From
just
Surah Hujurat.
For the record, just to make it clear, it's not just the Muslim ladies who could listen to this episode. I guess it's even good for Muslim men to go for it, because as we just mentioned previously, it is not just the women who are engaged in these sort of things like gossipings, because they have more of gatherings and personal sort of stuff together. So it could happen for all men and women. But since this program is dedicated to all the Muslim ladies from all around the world, we want to see them in a perfect picture. That's why we hint on some very sensitive topics.
Right. So you asked about why there's such a horrible comparison. Well, the verse in itself is giving the answer. First of all, the root cause of your backbiting is suspecting.
Yeah.
Do not suspect. Number two, it's saying la tajassus, do not spy. So these are the two root causes that can actually lead you to backbiting or sometimes listening, as we said in the previous episodes. Like you sometimes listen in amazement. You don't say much, but you said, oh, I never knew that. Oh, really? Is that so? Like these kind of statements. These
but it's very
encourage.
Difficult to ignore it, you know?
It is. But right here, if we understand why there is such a horrible comparison, nobody will actually like to go towards it. First of all Muslims are brothers and sisters together. That's why the word brother has come here, because it's like you're talking about any believer. Number two, why is it dead? Because that person is absent.
Yeah.
A dead person can't defend himself.
Exactly.
So the person who is absent, well, you're talking about him. You're at ease because that person is not present in front of you. And you know that person is unavailable to defend himself or herself.
Yeah.
So when they are absent, you are at ease talking anything and you go free and you never know how long you go ahead. And this is one reason why is it compared with the dead? Because that person is absent and unable to defend. Because a dead person is also unable to defend himself.
Exactly.
Number one. Number two. When a flesh of a dead is eaten, who does so? The wild animals. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is reminding us that this kind of character, this kind of virtue is those of the wild. It's not of the humans.
Predators.
Yeah. So don't be predators. Be humans.
Exactly.
I have created you as humans. Be humans. Act like humans.
So human beings, act just as your nature. Let's go for a short break and then we'll be back to see the rest of the story. Backbiting is a sad thing that we all are engaged in, and we know that this flaw exists in our personality and it might happen too much on a daily basis, but we have to work on it. And I guess everything would be pretty much easier when you go for practicing. So welcome back. This is Muslim Lady. We're talking about backbiting. And we want to know more how a Muslim lady can refrain herself from getting into backbiting.
Yeah, so we're talking about the horrible comparison, the weird kind of comparison Quran is making in Surah Hajarat of backbiters with those eating the flesh of the dead. So we said that eating the flesh of the dead is a quality of wild, and we have to act human, we don't have to act wild. Number two, just imagine if a flesh from a dead body is eaten, can the body regenerate skin again? Can the body develop the cells again? Can the skin be regenerated again? No, because the dead is dead. In the same way, when you backbite about a living person, that person, since absent, is unable to defend himself. You can't get back that reputation again. You humiliated his reputation.
So the whole story lays behind the reputation and the dignity of another Muslim person.
Exactly. And because that, number two, flesh gives beauty to the skeleton.
Yeah.
Just imagine when a flesh from a body is taken away, it remains a skeleton.
Yeah.
So you're taking away the beauty of another person.
So
that's again the reputation.
So you actually are destroying the picture of another person in front of other people.
Yeah, and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is not going to forgive this, because Prophet, peace be upon him, says that it's the worst sin than as if someone committed adultery, zina. Why? Because if someone committed adultery, he can go for forgiveness, ask for forgiveness, can repent, and maybe Allah will forgive that person. But Allah will not forgive a backbiter until the victim forgives that person. Now you never know. Sometimes you carry on backbiting about people.
Yeah.
And you never know. You were sitting in the gathering of ladies. Who did I talk about, really?
Mm-hmm.
Where do I find that person again? Will I ever see that person again or not?
Well, sister, actually, the situation gets worse when it becomes a habit of yours.
Exactly. So no human being likes that his book of deeds would be empty of all the good deeds he did. Why we do that? It's because of ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
Why we do that is because of unawareness. And when we will be aware that our good deeds, when we talk about someone, will be transferred into the book of deeds of other person, and on that day when we will be, our book of deeds will be given to us, and we'll say, "Oh Allah, it's empty. I have
done too many of goodness. Where are they?
I know. I helped an orphan. I know I went to Hajj. I know I went to Ziyara. I know I did so many good things. But this is all,
it has been exchanged because you have talked behind somebody's back.
Exactly. And if that will not happen, now we will say Allah is Rahman, Allah is Rahim, but at the same time, He's just.
Yeah,
He's
exactly.
fair enough.
Mm-hmm.
He said, I will be transferring your good deeds into the book of deeds of others. So we have to be refraining from it.
Exactly.
And even we can remind ourselves of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, who says that, like a disease, for example, a deadly disease, for example, just take an example of cancer.
Yeah.
It consumes a particular organ and destroys it. Imam Sadiq al-Islam, reporting from Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him and his purified family, says that backbiting is swifter than that. It is like this disease that consumes the faith of a human being and destroys it.
Yeah, and it would actually slander all the soul of that person. So let's go for a short break, and then after that, we'd come with the last part of today's episode. Thank you for staying with us.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Well, yes, you're listening to Muslim Lady, and we're talking about backbiting. Nobody likes to eat the flesh of their fellow's dead body. So we should consider this fact too much. Whenever we're talking, just imagine the situation when we are with our close friends and we think like, okay, I'm not doing anything horrible, but then unfortunately and unconsciously, I'm doing that. I'm eating the flesh of another person's body without even being aware of it. So the problem, as we just talked about, is the right of another person and also their reputation and their dignity, which is so important and valuable to God. So we should respect every single human being in their absence and in their presence. So is there anything remaining?
Exactly. So, you know, eating the flesh of the dead, how is it for humans? It contains bacteria, it contains microbes. That means it is the worst form of ethics to backbite about someone. And if you do that, eating dead flesh will make a person definitely ill. That means if you backbite, it in itself contains so many microbes, yeah. That is the worst form of other akhlaq, the worst form of other ethics. If you backbite, you will start lying, you will start spying, you will start suspecting mm-hmm. others, you will start doing all those things which we have been.
And you would think that, okay, all the sins, you would belittle all the sins in your eyes. You would think that, okay, I'm not doing much of a thing, it's not a sin.
Or I'm actually talking about someone, he really is like that, or she really is like that. But that is what is called ghiba, that's what's called backbiting. Otherwise, if that quality is not in that person, you're actually slandering them, you're actually defaming them. And we should remember that Prophet, peace be upon him and his purified family, said that no fire is faster in consuming dry wood than backbiting is in consuming devotees' virtues.
Yeah.
So we must remember our all good virtues can get consumed away, can get, mm-hmm. you know, taken away, transferred
exactly.
to the book of deeds of others.
Yeah.
We should be careful about it.
So
the more we take care about these things, the more we are aware, as Imam Ali Alisam also said, think before you speak.
Exactly. Because once the word is uttered, it's out of the prison of your mouth and
consider,
you cannot control it.
Consider the 32 teeth that Allah has given you as the 32 watchmen.
Yeah.
Before you speak.
Exactly. Thank you, sister. And thank you to our listeners very much. So we should be careful about every single act we do. And that's it. This was all for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. Until another session. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Who is the lover?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah. Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger. To Allah is our return.
The Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity. Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He is the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes, so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
Chapter 49, verse 13.
La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger, to Allah is our return.
The Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men, and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime's practices against Palestinian children include arresting them in the dead of night, arresting them without a court order and without explanation, handcuffing and blindfolding them, preventing their parents, family members or lawyers from accompanying them, and subjecting them to beatings and insults. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote in this regard, in its latest attack on Gaza, the Zionist regime killed at least 33 Palestinians within 5 days. The attack was accompanied by calls from the Zionist regime's government ministers, including the overt fascist Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich, for greater violence, in effect the intensification of genocide. Gaza has long been acquainted with the Zionist regime's policies of extermination, yet not a single action has been taken against the Zionist regime by any country nor by any Western democracy. The failure of the United Nations to hold the Zionist regime accountable for its crimes indicates complicity. That is precisely why Palestinian civil society issued its 2005 call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions. Such appeals are not addressed to the sanctimonious international community, but rather to solidarity groups and other civil society organizations around the world. Palestinians have advocated effective campaigning with the aim of compelling the fabricated regime of Israel to end its aggression against Gaza and the West Bank. The apartheid regime of Israel would not be able to commit all its war crimes against Palestinians in general, and Gazans in particular, without the full impunity offered by the international community. That is a glaring fact. It is unnecessary to remind the civilized world that the fabricated regime of Israel has mounted a continuous wave of attacks against the civilian population in Gaza. In September 2007, Gaza was declared an enemy entity. The Zionist regime prevented a wide range of food and basic materials from being imported into Gaza. It was even revealed that the Zionist regime's bureaucrats decided how many calories people in Gaza could consume. Fuel and electricity were cut too. Gaza has endured an electricity crisis for many years. The Zionist regime has turned Gaza into the largest concentration camp in the world. Its people have to dig tunnels so that they can bring fuel, medicine, and other necessities from Egypt into Gaza. True, we do hear words of sympathy from international community. One wonders what it will take to translate those words into action. Children killed in the early hours of the morning? Among the seven children killed in Gaza recently were 4-year-old Hajar al-Bahtini and Ali, and Mayar Ezzedine, aged 8 and 12. U.S.-sourced warplanes were used to bomb their homes. Other children were orphaned. The dentist and hospital administrator Jamal Khaswan and his wife Mervat were killed, along with one of their sons. They leave behind 4 other children. To the Zionist regime, the children it killed were just collateral damage of its military onslaught, grotesquely named Operation Shield and Arrow. To justify the dehumanization of Palestinian children, Maurice Hirsch, who spent almost 2 decades in the Zionist regime's military advocate general corps, tweeted that while the incidental loss of life of non-combatants is always unfortunate, the laws of war take into account that this is a possible and even legitimate result. And in much worse tweet, he goes further, considering the military advantage gained by eliminating these senior terrorists, it is irrelevant to ask how many children were incidentally killed. Hirsch's words encapsulate the Zionist ideology. Under the Zionist regime's genocidal, settler, colonial doctrine, the lives of the natives are irrelevant. Natives have to be eliminated so that white European colonizers, in this case Jewish supremacists, can flourish. According to the UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights, everyone has the right to a standard of living adequate for the health and well-being of himself and of his family, including food, clothing, housing, and medical care, and necessary social services, and the right to security in the event of unemployment, sickness, disability, widowhood, old age, or other lack of livelihood in circumstances beyond his control. Apparently, that right does not apply to the Palestinians. Such is the cruel logic of settler colonialism of the fabricated regime of Israel. Meanwhile, Arab News reported the Zionist regime security forces arrest about 1,000 Palestinian children from the streets, schools and homes of the West Bank each year, and about the same number from East Al-Quds on suspicion of involvement in attacks or protest. Children's rights organizations say such practices are abusive and harm youngsters' physical and mental health. They are prohibited by international laws and agreements related to the children's rights, to which the Zionist regime is a signatory. According to the organizations, the Zionist regime's practices against Palestinian children include arresting them in the dead of night, arresting them without a court order and without explanation, handcuffing and blindfolding them, preventing their parents, family members or lawyers from accompanying them, and subjecting them to beatings and insults. The bodies say that children are exposed to physical pain and psychological pressure and go through experiences of loneliness, intense fear, confusion, humiliation, helplessness, and sometimes a sense of danger of death. They add that many children report severe post-traumatic symptoms following their release. Jessica Montel, executive director at Israel-based human rights organization Ha Moked, told Arab News, "Israel ignores its legal obligation to consider the child's best interest when it comes to Palestinian children wanted for interrogation. Traumatic night arrest remain the default method for bringing in Palestinian children. Hamoket has petitioned the Israeli High Court against this practice. We are demanding the Israeli military send a summons to parents when children are wanted for questioning. Qadoura Fares, director of the Palestinian Prisoners Club, told Arab News that the Zionist regime's military authorities 5 years ago introduced amendments to the law of military occupation in the West Bank and the civilian law in East Al-Quds to allow the arrest and trial of children aged 12 and upwards. Fares added that a series of alternative punishments have been adopted in East Al-Quds, such as fines, release on bail or house arrest, a 1 or 2 month in which the child's family deposits $6,000 with the court, and the amount is confiscated if the child leaves his home during the period of house arrest. Fares said house arrest for children is more difficult than ordinary imprisonment, as this method makes parents jailers for their children so they do not lose the money. Many children who are detained at home hate their parents, who have to ensure they remain imprisoned in the house until the end of the sentence, he said. A total of 160 Palestinian children are currently serving sentences in the Zionist regime prisons after being arrested for joining protests, raising the Palestinian flag or throwing stones. An Israeli settler shot dead a Palestinian recently. Ala Ghaysiyeh, 28, was killed in the settlement of Tana Umrim in Az-Zihriya, southwest of Al-Khalil. The shooting brought the number of Palestinians killed by the Zionist regime occupation forces and settlers since the beginning of the year to 157, including 36 in Gaza during May. The total includes 26 children. 4 Palestinians were wounded by live bullets during clashes with the Zionist regime military forces, while settlers burnt 5 vehicles and 270 bales of straw between the villages of Tor Musaya and Al-Mughaber, east of Ramallah. The Zionist regime army has begun arresting members of the Popular Front for Liberation of Palestine. The Zionist regime intelligence officers are texting PFLP members, warning them not to participate in activities of the organization. A former prisoner and member of the PFLP confirmed to Arab News that he had received a message adding that warnings had recently increased from the Zionist regime's intelligence agency, Shin Bet. It has been reported that more than 100 Palestinians affiliated with PFLP have been arrested in recent weeks.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. We'll be right back.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.